Hello and welcome to this, the second of my special mini-series on colonial psychiatry in Africa. I'm Rab Houston, Professor of Modern History in the University of St Andrews in Scotland. And at the end of the last podcast, you might remember I explained what was special about colonial psychiatry from the 1880s to the 1960s. Compared with what was happening back in the metropolitan, in other words, back in the United Kingdom. There were 5 points there, and I'm going to deal with the first three of them. They are continuing medical pluralism, limited institutionalization of patients, and professionalization of mental health services, and persistently low resources. In subsequent podcasts, in other words, the last two in the series of four, I'm going to deal with attempts to introduce European-style practices of care and the pervasive role of racism. So, first of all, medical pluralism. An important theme in my podcasts on the history of psychiatry in Britain and Ireland from 1500 to the present day, was the enduring importance of different ways of dealing with people who were described as mad. And that included religious healing and traditional talking therapies, as well as formal or learned medicine. This medical pluralism meant that there was, in effect, a marketplace for therapies, which were chosen according to the availability of practitioners, the cost of treatment, the nature of the sufferer's condition, the sufferer experiencing it, in other words, their own personality and context, and the social setting in which the illness had presented itself. In all this, biomedicine was arguably secondary, and it really only gained dominance during the 19th and 20th centuries. In colonial and post-colonial Africa, the power of biomedicine remains to this day, tempered by long-established healing practices. And I think mental health care in sub-Saharan Africa exemplifies continuing medical pluralism, which British doctors first encountered in colonial times. Malawi, Zambia, and Zimbabwe had a common indigenous healing culture of therapy management groups, herbal or spiritual healers, variously known as Singangas or Nyangas and Sangomas, and regional shrines. Herbal remedies, divinatory healing, and Western biomedicine vied for business in this very rich context. African medical assistants, hospital administrators, and midwives, all of these were quite often Christians, brokered between indigenous and Western medicine, translating somatic presentations into psychological categories that white clinicians could treat. So colonial dispensaries or hospitals were meeting points between biomedicine, local healers, and sufferers. Local healers, for their part, gained access to Western ideas and mediated them, while intermediaries could also promote Western practices. As a result, many medical interventions in colonial psychiatry were neither wholly colonial nor wholly indigenous, but a hybrid of the two. In the modern West, the distinction between patient and practitioner is based primarily on power, qualifications, and knowledge. In colonial Africa, different religious views also played an important role, as they had done in historic Britain, where sufferers often sought out a doctor who was of their faith. Not all traditional healing in colonial Africa involved magic, but it did often have a supernatural component. Endowed with a high degree of moral legitimacy, because it respected lineages, divinatory healing was widely used. In this scheme, madness was conceived as a family or community event in which a mad person passed a message to the group, possibly from a spirit or witch doctor. Healers interpreted the message the sick person was trying to get over and, by investigation and ritual, sought to restore the social equilibrium and thus the psychic balance of the individual. The process is therefore primarily psycho-social. By promising optimism, the healer persuaded the sufferer to be more positive about their mental health. So this is a sort of self-induced healing. Some modern evidence suggests that traditional healers can help to relieve distress and to improve mild symptoms in common mental disorders such as depression and anxiety. However, the same studies suggest that such healers cannot bring about significant change in the course of severe mental illnesses such as bipolar and psychotic disorders. Indigenous medicine may be cheaper, more socially responsive, and, to current thinking, culturally acceptable than Western biomedicine. However, biomedicine does things which traditional healing cannot, and I think that means that we should see the two as complementary rather than exclusive. Now, there remain two problems in providing therapies. Firstly, the resources to deliver biomedicine were, and still are, very limited in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa. The critical mixture of poor staffing levels, lack of trained personnel, insufficient availability of appropriate psychotropic medicines, underfunded facilities, and widespread popular stigma regarding mental illness have combined to ensure that in sub-Saharan countries, mental health service provision has continued to be poor. The broader epidemiological context created further problems. There may have been either misdiagnosis or concurrent infection with parasitic disease, such as trypanosomiasis, commonly known as sleeping sickness. As the neurological or meningoencephalic stage of this evolves, it brings about changes in behaviour, confusion, sensory disturbances, poor coordination, and, of course, the characteristic disturbance of the sleep cycle, which gives the condition its name. The second problem in developing therapies is that little progress has been made over the decades or even centuries towards genuine accommodations between Western and traditional African paradigms as regards meanings of symptomatology, diagnostics, or treatment approaches. That was certainly the case as late as the 1970s, and I think there still remains a gap. So, moving away from medical pluralism, which outsiders provided medical care and where? Ethnopsychiatrists in British Southern Africa, Southern and Eastern Africa in fact, were usually non-specialists until the middle of the 20th century. Most of the early ones were trained in Scotland as either general physicians or surgeons. almost all were male. They were state employees, and thus they were part of the administration of the colonies. Like magistrates, colonial clinicians had little contact with each other, but they were all guided by the same assumptions about class, race, and gender. And their concern was primarily with the mental disorders of black people. And I'll talk about those concerns and the racial implications of them next time. A European psychiatric presence was largely absent from most of Africa until the early years of the 20th century, when asylums for the criminal insane were first established. In Nyasaland, for example, the Zomba Lunatic Asylum for the Criminal Insane was an annex of the Central Prison, opened in 1910, and an ordinance regulating institutionalisation was first promulgated in 1913. Police and state officials handled most commitments to the asylum. It was custodial in nature, poorly resourced, and chronically overcrowded. However, it's important to recognise the initiative of family members in having a person committed. Their influence can be discerned if we read the official committal papers closely. So it's not just an imposition from above. Definitions of madness were, in some instances, negotiated, as was committal, rather than simply a form of colonial social control imposed by the colonialists. Ordinary asylums for non-criminals came later still, from the 1930s onwards. Following changes in the United Kingdom with the Mental Health Act of 1930, Zomba was renamed a mental hospital in 1951, with new pavilion-style wards under the direct control of the Colonial Medical Department rather than the Department of Prisons. Yet, even as late as that date, there was no resident psychiatrist. Formal institutions remained few and small. Zomba in 1912 had just 18 patients, 30 in 1919, 150 in 1951. Right up to this day, when it has about 250 patients, Zomba remains the only state-run mental hospital in Malawi, though district hospitals staffed by psychiatric nurses mean more treatment is available locally. Again, this echoed changing practices in the United Kingdom, where outpatient treatment in general hospitals began to replace inpatient care in asylums from the 1930s onwards, though it was not accelerated until the 1970s and the 1980s. After Malawi's independence, the nurses I've just mentioned were initially sent to Britain for specialist psychiatric training as mental health services personnel and approach became increasingly Africanized. The British and the French, despite what I've said, did more to provide asylums than other colonial powers in Africa. But overall, institutions were much less important to provision for the insane of colonial Africa than in Britain, at least between the 1840s and the 1970s and 1980s. I've been talking so far about black Africans. Pre-19th century theories about madness in the wider world are related primarily to what happened to Europeans when they moved to different climates. The racial superiority of those raised in temperate climes over those where temperatures were extreme was taken for granted. Conventional wisdom also held that adverse effects on the mind caused by excess heat and light could only really be remedied by repatriation. Now, that assumption was mainly applied to British India in the 18th and the early 19th century, because that was where colonialism was most developed in its early years. Tens of thousands of white men, it was mostly white men, lived and worked there under the Raj. The East India Company, which was an independent business enterprise, effectively charged with running India during the 18th century, established private asylums for its employees, and these were taken over by the British colonial administration in the early 19th century. In Africa, by contrast, psychiatric institutions came long after first colonization. In Africa too, repatriation was the preferred way of dealing with white madness, even if some asylums, and I'm thinking here particularly of Cape Colony, did house white paying patients. But it was the psychopathology of natives, rather than the British, which was the main focus of attention. Defining a specifically African insanity fascinated psychiatrists in Nyasaland, Nigeria, Rhodesia, and British East Africa. Now, those examples show that psychiatry differed greatly between parts of the British Empire. It was different again in French, Dutch, German, Portuguese, and Italian colonies, even within the African continent alone. I think it's too crude to say that psychiatry in sub-Saharan Africa was an instrument of political oppression. The power wielded by psychiatrists was limited, and in any case, there were laws, prisons, military force, education, evangelization, taxation, deportation, any number of strategies to subjugate black populations. Psychiatry did, however, provide an intellectual underpinning for colonial rule by stressing the mental inferiority of black people. Unified theories of African deficiency in brain, morality, and intellect validated Western ideas of citizenship, economic rationality, and moral superiority. Now, you may find those assertions controversial. This podcast is drawing to a close, and I'm going to talk about some of the assertions I've just made there in more depth in the third and then in the fourth and last podcast of this mini-series. Now, they're going to deal with the final two characteristics of colonial psychiatry, which I identified last week, and that's attempts to introduce European-style practices of care, and the central, indeed the overpowering, importance of racism. I hope you'll join me, and thank you for listening.